so out there that sometimes, years later in New York, he would ask, what happened on that trip? With us was Carrie Ann Moeller, now Mrs. Chris Jagger. I think the Hollies wrote a song about her. It was about Marianne. Very sweet girl. Had a place on Portland Square, where I lived when in town for about 2 years. Her reminiscences, which I sought out recently for this book, were quite different from mine. But hers were at least not almost a total blank like mine. What is clear to me now is that we never thought we were overworked, but later on, you realise you didn't give yourself a break, boy. So when we had 3 unfamiliar days off, we got a little wild. I remembered going in a chauffeur-driven car, but Carrie Ann says we didn't have a chauffeur. We went in a cramped 2-door car with one other identifiable passenger. So maybe we did have a chauffeur. According to Carrie Ann, we started in Dolly's nightclub, the precursor of Tramp, and drove round Hyde Park Corner several times, wondering where to go. We drove to John's house in the country, she says, and said hi to Cynthia, and then Carrie Ann decided we'd go and visit her mum in Lyme Regis. What a nice visit for her mother. A couple of flying acid heads who'd been up for a couple of nights. We got there about dawn, so her story goes. One greasy spoon calf wouldn't serve us. John got recognised. And Carrie Ann realised that we couldn't go and visit her mother because we were so out of it. There follow, therefore, some missing hours because we didn't get back to John's house until after dark. There were palm trees, so it looks as if we sat on the Torquay palm-lined esplanade for a great many hours, engrossed in a little world of our own. We got home, and so everyone was happy. It was one of those cases of John wanting to do more drugs than me. Huge bag of weed, lump of hash, and acid. I usually pick my spots with acid. Moving around didn't come into it if you could avoid it. I liked John a lot. He was a silly sod in many ways. I used to criticise him for wearing his guitar too high. They used to wear them up by their chests, which really constricts your movement. It's like being handcuffed. Got your fucking guitar on your fucking chin, for Christ's sake. It ain't a violin. I think they thought it was a cool thing. Jerry and the Pacemakers, all the Liverpool bands did it. We used to fuck around like that. Try a longer strap, John. The longer the strap, the better you play. I remember him nodding and taking it in. Next time I saw them, the guitar straps were a little lower. I'd say, no wonder you don't swing, you know? No wonder you can only rock. No wonder you can't roll. John could be quite direct. The only rude thing I remember him saying to me was about my solo in the middle of It's All Over Now. He thought it was crap. Maybe he got out the wrong side of the bed that day. Okay, it certainly could have been better. But you disarmed the man. Yeah, it wasn't one of my best, John. Sorry, sorry it jars, old boy. You can play it any fucking way you like. But that he even bothered to listen meant that he was very interested. He was so open. And anybody else could be embarrassing. But John had this honesty in his eyes that made you go for him. Had an intensity, too. He was a one-off. Like me, we were attracted to each other in a strange way. Definitely a two-alpha clash to start with. Post-acid was the prevailing mood at Redlands on a cold February morning in 1967. Post-acid. Everybody arrives back with their feet on the ground, so to speak, and you've been with them all day, doing all kind of nut things and laughing your head off. You've gone for walks on the beach, and you're freezing cold, and you're not wearing any shoes, and you're wondering why you've got frostbite. The come down hits everybody in a different way. Some people are going, let's do it again, and others are going, enough already. and you can flash back into full acid drive at any moment. There's a knock at the door. I look through the window, and there's this whole lot of dwarves outside, but they're all wearing the same clothes. They were policemen, but I didn't know it. They just looked like very small people, wearing dark blue with shiny bits and helmets. Wonderful attire, am I expecting you? Anyway, come on in, it's a bit chilly out. They were trying to read a warrant to me. Oh, that's very nice, but it's a bit cold outside. Come on in and read it to me over the fireplace. I'd never been busted before and I was still on acid. Ah, make friends, love. Not for me would there be. You cannot come in until I speak to my lawyer. It was, yeah, come on in. And then roughly disabused. While we're gently bouncing down from the acid, they're trampling through the place, doing what they've got to do. And none of us are really taking much notice of them. Obviously, there was a shiver of the usuals, but there didn't seem to be much we could do about it at that moment, so we just let them walk about and look in ashtrays. Incredibly enough, what they did come up with was only a few roaches and what Mick and Robert Fraser had in their pockets, which was a minute amount of amphetamine, bought legally by Mick in Italy, and in Robert's case, heroin tabs. Otherwise, we just carried on. There was the thing, of course, of Marianne. Hard day on acid, she'd taken a bath upstairs, just finished, and I had this huge fur rug made of pelts of some kind, rabbit, and she just wrapped herself up in it. I think she had a towel around her too and was lying back on a couch after a nice bath. How the Mars bar got into the story, I don't know. Well, there was one on the table. Well, there were a couple. Because on acid, suddenly, you get sugar-lack and you're munching away. And so she's stuck forever with the story of where the police found that Mars bar. And you have to say, she wears it well. But how that connotation came about and how the press managed to make a Mars bar on a table and Marianne, wrapped in a fur rug, into a myth is a kind of classic. In fact, Marianne was quite chastely attired for once. Usually, when first you said hi to Marianne, you started talking to the cleavage, and she knew she was thrusting it. A naughty lady, bless her heart. She was more dressed in this fur bedspread than she'd been all day. So they had a woman police officer who took her upstairs and made her drop the rug. What else do you want to see? From there, shows you what's in people's minds, the evening paper headlines are Naked Girl at Stone's Party. Info directly from the police. But the Mars bar is a dildo? Oh, that's rather a large leap. The weird thing about these myths is that they stick when they're so obviously false. Perhaps the idea is that it's so outlandish or crude or prurient that it can't have been invented. Imagine allowing a group of policemen and women to see this evidence, keeping it on display as they came tramping through the house. Excuse me, officer, I think you may have missed something. Over here. Others at Redlands that day were Christopher Gibbs and Nicky Kramer, an upper-class drifter and hanger-on who befriended everybody, a harmless enough soul who was innocent of betraying us, although David Litvinoff held him out of a window by his ankles to find out. And of course, Mr. X, as he was later referred to in court, David Schneiderman. Schneiderman, who also went by the moniker of Acid King, was the source of that very high-quality acid of the time, such brands as Strawberry Fields, Sunshine, and Purple Haze. Where do you think Jimmy got that from? All kinds of mixtures. And that's how Schneiderman got in on the crowd, by providing this super-duper acid. In those innocent days, now abruptly ended, nobody bothered about the cool guy, the dealer in the corner. One big happy party. In fact, the cool guy was the agent of the constabulary. He came with this bag full of goodies, including a lot of DMT, which we'd never had before. Dimethyltryptamine. One of the ingredients of ayahuasca, a very powerful psychedelic. He was at every party for about 2 weeks, and then mysteriously disappeared and was never seen again. The bust was a collusion between the News of the World and the cops. But the shocking extent of the stitch-up, which reached to the judiciary, didn't become apparent until the case came to court months later. Mick had threatened to sue the scandal rag for mixing him up with Brian Jones and describing him taking drugs in a nightclub. In return, they wanted evidence against Mick to defend themselves in court. It was Patrick, my Belgian chauffeur, who sold us out to the News of the World, who in turn tipped off the cops, who used Schneiderman. I'm paying this driver handsomely, and the gig's the gig. Keep shtum. But the News of the World got to him. Didn't do him any good. As I heard it, he never walked the same again. But it took us time to piece these little details together. As far as I remember, the atmosphere was fairly relaxed at the time. Shit, anything we'd done already. It was only later on, the next day, when we started to get the letters from solicitors and everything, Her Majesty's Government, and blah, 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 we thought, this is serious. We decided to get out of England and not go back until it was time for the court case. And it would be better to find somewhere where we could get legal drugs. It was one of those sudden things. Let's jump in the Bentley and go to Morocco. So in early March, we did a runner. We've got free time and we've got the best car to do it in. This was Blue Lena, as it was christened. My dark blue Bentley, my S3 Continental Flying Spur. An automobile of some rarity. One of a limited edition of 87. It was named in honour of Lena Horne. I sent her a picture of it. Having this car was already heading for trouble. Breaking the rules of the establishment, driving a car I was definitely not born into. Blue Lena carried us on many an acid fuel journey. Modifications included a secret compartment in the frame for the concealing of illegal substances. It had a huge bonnet, and to turn it, you really had to swing it about. Blue Lena required some art and knowledge of its contours and tight situations. It was 6 inches wider at the back than the front. You got to know your car, no doubt about that. 3 tons of machinery. A car that was made to be driven fast at night. Brian and Anita had been to Morocco the previous year, 1966, staying with Christopher Gibbs, who had to take Brian to hospital with a broken wrist after a punch he'd thrown at Anita had hit the metal window frame in the El Minzah Hotel in Tangier. He was never good at connecting with Anita. I learned later just how violent Brian had already become with her as the downward slide began. Throwing knives, glass, punches at her, forcing her to barricade herself behind sofas. It's probably not well known that Anita had a very sporty childhood. Sailing, swimming, skiing, outdoor sports of every kind. Brian was no match for Anita, physically or in terms of wit. She was always on top of it. He always came off second best. And she thought, at the start at least, that Brian's rampages were quite funny, but they were becoming unfunny and dangerous. Anita told me later that at Torremolinos, on the way to Tangier the previous year, they had had massive fights, after which Brian ended up in jail. And Anita, too, once for stealing a car coming out of a club. She was often trying to bail Brian out, screaming at the turnkeys, "You can't keep him in jail. Let him out." All this time, they had grown to look like each other. Their hair and clothes were becoming identical. They'd merged their personas, stylistically at least. We flew to Paris, Brian, Anita and I, and met Deborah Dixon, an old friend of Anita, in the Hotel George V. Deborah was a piece of work, a beauty from Texas who had been on every magazine cover in the early 60s. Brian and Anita first met on the Stones tour, but it was in Deborah's house in Paris that they first got together. My new driver to replace the snitch Patrick, Tom Keelock, tough bloke from North London, soon to become the Stones' fixer-in-chief, brought Blue Lena over to Paris and we set off for the sun. I sent a postcard to Mum. Dear Mum, sorry I didn't phone before I left, but my telephones aren't safe to talk on. Everything will be all right, so don't worry. It's really great here, and I'll send you a letter when I get where I'm going. All my love, your fugitive son, Keith. Brian, Deborah, and Anita occupied the back seat, and I sat in the front next to Tom Keelock, changing the 45s on the little Philips car record player. It's hard to know on this journey how and why the tension built up in the car as it did. It was helped on by Brian being even more obnoxious and childish than usual. Tom's an old soldier. Ford at Arnhem and everything like that. But even he couldn't ignore the tension in that car. Brian's relationship with Anita had reached a jealous stalemate when she refused to give up whatever acting work she was doing to fulfill domestic duties as his full-time geisha, flatterer, punchbag, whatever he imagined, including partaker in orgies, which Anita always resolutely refused to do. On this trip, he never stopped complaining and whining about how ill he felt, how he couldn't breathe. No one took him seriously. Brian certainly suffered from asthma, but he was also a hypochondriac. Meanwhile, I was the DJ. I had to keep feeding the goddamn thing with little 45s. The favourite sounds, much Motown at the time. Anita claims that these choices were full of meaning and communication to her. Songs of the moment like Chantilly Lace and Hey Joe. All songs are like that. You can take the meaning any way you want. The first night of our journey through France, we stayed all in the same room. Five of us in a kind of dormitory in the top of a house. The only accommodation we could find late at night. Next day, we got to a town called Cordes-sur-Ciel that Deborah wanted to see. A pretty village on top of a hill. And from out of its medieval walls, as we approached, emerged an ambulance. And at this point, Brian insisted that we should follow it to the nearest hospital, which was in Albi. There, Brian was diagnosed with pneumonia. Well, it was hard to know with Brian what was real and what wasn't. But this meant that he was transferred to a Toulouse hospital, where he would stay for several days, and it was there we left him. I discovered much later that he gave instructions to Deborah not to leave Anita and me alone together. So it was pretty clear to him. We said, okay, Brian, you're cool. We'll drive down through Spain, then you fly over to Tangier. So Anita and Deborah and I drove into Spain, and when we reached Barcelona, we went out to a famous flamenco guitar joint in the Ramblas. Then it was a rough part of town. And when we came outside about 3 a.m, there was a semi-riot going on. People were throwing things at the Bentley violently, especially when they saw us. Maybe they were anti-rich, anti-us. Maybe it was because I was flying the Pope's flag that day. I used to have a little flagpole on the car and I would change the flags around. The cops came and suddenly I'm in kangaroo court in the middle of the night in Barcelona. a low room with tiles, and a judge presiding over these nocturnal assizes. Opposite him, a long bench with about 100 guys all lined up, with me at the end of the row. And suddenly, these cops came in, and they started to beat everyone down the line with truncheons round their head. Everyone got one. And they knew what was coming. It looked to me like a pretty normal process. You get into that court at night, and you get the usual. And I'm the last cat on the end of the bench. Tom went to get my passport and took hours. And when he finally procured it, I flashed it in the face. Her Majesty demands. And they did the guy right next to me. After about 99 broken heads, I guess they were going to do the whole bench. But they didn't. The judge wanted me to confirm the culprits they had chosen, having rounded up the usual suspects, to charge with smashing the car and causing the riot. But I wouldn't do that. So it came down to a fine for parking in the wrong place, a piece of paper to sign, money to change hands, and even then they kept us in jail for the rest of the night. Next day, we got the windscreen fixed and set off with fresh hope. But not with Deborah, who had had enough of tension and police cells and wanted to go back to Paris. With no one to watch over us, we drove on to Valencia. And between Barcelona and Valencia, Anita and I found out that we were really interested in each other. I have never put the make on a girl in my life. I just don't know how to do it. My instincts are always to leave it to the woman, which is kind of weird, but I can't pull the come on bit. Hey, baby, how you doing? Come on, let's get it on and all of that. I'm tongue-tied. I suppose every woman I've been with, they've had to put the make on me. Meanwhile, I'm putting the make on in another way, by creating an aura of insufferable tension. Somebody has to do something. You either get the message or you don't, but I could never make the first move. I knew how to operate amongst women, because most of my cousins were women, so I felt very comfortable in their company. If they're interested, they'll make the move. That's what I found out. So Anita made the first move. I could just not put the make on my friend's girl. Even though he'd become an arsehole to Anita too. It's the Sir Galahad in me. Anita was beautiful too. And we got closer and closer. And then suddenly, without her old man, she had the balls to break the ice and say, fuck it. In the back of the Bentley, somewhere between Barcelona and Valencia, Anita and I looked at each other. The tension was so high in the back seat. The next thing I know, she's giving me a blowjob. The tension broke then. And suddenly, we're together. You don't talk a lot when that shit hits you. Without even saying things, you have the feeling. The great sense of relief that something has been resolved. It was February, and in Spain it was early spring. Going through England and France, it was pretty chill, it was winter. We got over the Pyrenees, and within half an hour already, it was spring. And by the time we got to Valencia, it was summer. I still remember the smell of the orange trees in Valencia. When you get laid with Anita Pallenberg for the first time, you remember things. We stopped in Valencia overnight and checked in as Count and Countess Ziggenpuss. And that was the first time I made love to Anita. And from Algeciras, where we checked in as Count and Countess Castiglione, we took the ferry in the car over to Tangier to the El Minza Hotel. There in Tangier were Robert Fraser, Bill Burroughs, Brian Gyson, Burroughs' friend and fellow cut-up artist, another of the hip public schoolboys, and Bill Willis, decorator of exiles' palaces. We were greeted by a bundle of telegrams from Brian, ordering Anita to come back and collect him. But we weren't going anywhere except the Casbah and Tangier. For a week or so, it's boinky, boinky, boinky down in the Casbah, and we're randy as rabbits, but we're also wondering how we're going to deal with it. Because we were expecting Brian in Tangier. We only dropped them off to have treatment. We were both, I remember, trying to be polite, at least for each other's benefit. When Brian gets to Tangier, we'll do this and that. Let's make a phone call to see if he's all right, and all of that. And at the same time, that was the last thing on our minds. The truth was, oh God, Brian's going to turn up in Tangier, and then we've got to start playing a fucking game. Yeah, I hope he croaks. Suddenly, it's Anita. Is she with him or with me? We realised we were creating an unmanageable situation, maybe threatening the survival of the band. We decided to pull back to make a strategic retreat. Anita didn't want to abandon Brian. Didn't want to go, tears and crying. She was worried about the effect on the group. That this was the big betrayal and it might bring it all down. I just can't be seen with you. It's too dangerous, baby. I just can't be. Yes, I gotta chill this thing with you. A song called Can't Be Seen. We visited Ahmed, a legendary hashish dealer of those early drug days. Anita had met him first with Chrissy Gibbs on a previous visit. A small Moroccan man with a Chinese jar on his shoulder walking along, looking back at them, leading them through the Medina, up the hill towards the Minza, opening the door into a tiny little shop that was completely empty, except for a box with a few pieces of Moroccan jewellery in it and a lot of hashish. His shop was on the stairs, called the Escalier Walla, going down from the Minza. Little one-story shops on the right-hand side that backed onto the Minza Gardens. Ahmed started off with one shop, and then he had two above it. There were steps between them. Internally, it was a bit of a labyrinth, and the higher ones just had a few brass beds with gaudy-coloured velvet mattresses on them, on which one could, having smoked a lot of dope, pass out for a day or two. And then you come in and he give you some more dope to make you more passed out. It was almost like a basement, and it was hung with all the wonders of the East. Kaftan, rugs, and beautiful lanterns. Aladdin's cave. It was a shack, but he made it look like a palace. Ahmed Holinghead, we used to call him. Because he said his prayers so often he had a hole in the middle of his forehead. He was a good salesman. First thing, he gets the mint tea, and then a pipe. He was somewhat on the spiritual side, and as he gave you your pipe, he would usually tell you some thrilling adventure of the prophet in the wilderness. He was a good ambassador for his faith and a cheerful soul. Also, a typical Moroccan little shyster. He had gaps in his teeth, and he had this great smile that never left. Once he started smiling, it was there all the time, and he kept looking at you. But he had such good shit, you kind of went to the land of milk and honey there. And after a few rounds of this, it was almost as if you were on acid. In and out he went, bringing sweet meats and candies, and it was very difficult to get out. You think you're going to have a quick one and then do something else, but very rarely would you do anything else. You could stay there all day, all night. You could live there. And always Radio Cairo was static, slightly off the tuning. The Moroccan specialty was keef. The leaf cut up with tobacco, which they smoked in long pipes. Zebzi, they called them, the tiny little bowl on the end. One hit in the morning with a cup of mint tea. But what Ahmed had in large quantities, in which he imbued with a new glamour, was a kind of hash. It was called hash because it came in chunks, but it wasn't hash, strictly speaking. Hash is made from the resin, and this was loose powder, like pollen, from the dried bud of the plant, compressed into shape, which is why it was that green colour. I heard that a way of collecting it was to cover children in honey and run them naked through a field of herb, and they come out the other end and they scraped them off. Ahmed had three or four different qualities, decided by which kind of stocking he put it through. There would be the coarser ones, and there would be the 24 denier, very close to the dirham, the money. The high quality one went through the finest, finest silk. It was just powder by then. That was my first touch of Africa. Within the short bus from Spain over to Tangier, you were in another world. It could have been 1,000 years ago, and you either went, how weird, or you went, wow, this is great. And we love to be transported. We were already heavy-duty smokers. One could say, we were going round as hash inspectors. We used to do so much of it. We must reconsider our ideas on drugs, wrote Cecil Beaton in his diary. It seems these boys live off them, yet they seem extremely healthy and strong. We will see. Anita's dilemma, apart from the guilt of his betrayal and her passionate and destructive attachment to Brian, was that Brian was still very wobbly and sick, and she felt she should look after him. So Anita went back to get Brian, took him from Toulouse to London for more medical attention, and then, with Marianne, who was coming to join Mick in Marrakesh for the weekend, brought him at first to Tangier. Brian had been doing a lot of acid, and he was in a weak physical state from his pneumonia. So to stiffen him up, Anita and Marianne, the nursing sisters, gave him a tab of acid on the plane. Anita and Marianne had both been up all the previous night on acid, and according to Anita, when they finally got to Tangier, some incident at Ahmed's, in which Marianne found her sari, the only item of clothing she had packed, unraveling and herself suddenly exposed, naked in the Casbah, caused panic to set in, especially in Brian, who ran back to the hotel, seized with fear. There they huddled in the corridors of the Minza Hotel, on straw mats, grappling with hallucinations. Not a good beginning to Brian's recuperation. We went to Marrakesh, the whole troop, including Mick, who was waiting there for Marianne. Beaton was twitching about us, admiring our breakfast arrangements and my marvellous torso. Beaton was mesmerised by Mick. I was fascinated with the thin, concave lines of his body, legs, arms. When Brian, Anita and Marianne got to Marrakesh, Brian must have sensed something, although Tom Keelock, who was the only person who knew about Anita and me, wouldn't have told him. And we're pretending barely to know each other. Yeah, we had a great trip, Brian. Everything was cool. Went to the Casbah. Valencia was lovely. The almost unbearable tension of the situation. And that was recorded by Michael Cooper in one of his most revealing photographs, and a chilling image in retrospect. The last picture of Anita and Brian and me together. It has a tension about it that still radiates. Anita staring straight at the camera, me and Brian looking grimly away in different directions, a joint in Brian's hand. Cecil Beaton took one of Mick and me and Brian, who's clutching his Ewer tape recorder, bags under his eyes, malevolent and sad. It's not surprising that little or no work was done. I don't remember doing or composing anything with Mick in Morocco, which was rare at the time. We were too occupied. It was obvious that Brian and Anita had come to the end of their tether. They'd beaten the shit out of each other. There was no point in it. I never really knew what the beef was. If I were Brian, I would have been a little bit sweeter and kept the bitch. But she was a tough girl. She certainly made a man out of me. She had had almost nothing but turbulent, abusive relationships, and she and Brian had always been fighting. She ran away screaming, being chased in tears. She'd been used to this for so long. It was almost reassuring and normal. It's not easy to get out of those destructive relationships, to know how to end them. And of course, Brian starts his old shit again in Marrakesh in the Asadi Hotel, trying to take Anita on for 15 rounds. His reaction to whatever he sensed between Anita and me was more violent. And once again, he breaks two ribs and a finger or something, and I'm watching it, hearing it. Brian was about to sign his own exit card and help Anita and me on our way. There's no point to this non-interference anymore. We're stuck in Marrakesh. This is the woman I'm in love with, and I've got to relinquish her out of some formality. All of my plans of rebuilding my relationship with Brian are obviously going straight down the drain. In the condition he was in, there was no point in building anything with Brian. I'd done my best. Now it was just unacceptable. Then Brian dragged two tattooed whores, remembered by Anita, incidentally, as really hairy girls, down a hotel corridor and into the room, trying to force Anita into a scene, humiliating her in front of them. He started to fling food at her from the many trays he'd ordered up. At that point, Anita ran to my room. I thought Anita wanted out of there, and if I could come up with a plan, she would take it. Sir Galahad again. But I wanted her back. I wanted to get out. I said, you didn't come to Marrakesh to worry that you've beaten up your old man so much he's lying in the bath with broken ribs. I can't take this shit anymore. I can't listen to you getting beaten up and fighting and all this crap. This is pointless. Let's get the hell out of here. Let's just leave him. We're having much more fun without him. It's been a very, very hard week for me, knowing that you're with him. Anita was in tears. She didn't want to leave, but she realized that I was right when I said that Brian would probably try and kill her. And so I planned the moonlight flit. When Cecil Beaton took that picture of me lying beside the pool at the hotel, I was actually figuring out an escape route. I was thinking, right, tell Tom to get the Bentley ready. It's just somewhere after sunset. We're getting out of here. The great moonlight flip from Marrakesh to Tangier was in motion. We set Brian Geisen up. We had Tom Keelock order him to take Brian into Marrakesh, into the Square of the Dead, with the musicians and acrobats, to do some recording with his Ewer tape recorder, to avoid what Tom had told him was an evasion of press hunting for Brian. And in the meantime, Anita and I drove to Tangier. We left late at night. Anita and I with Tom at the wheel. Mick and Marianne had already left. In some written work, Geisen recorded the devastating moment when Brian got back to the hotel and called him. Come quickly. They've all gone and left me. Cleared out. I don't know where they've gone. No message. The hotel won't tell me. I'm here all alone. Help me. Come at once, Geisen writes. I go over there. I get him into a bed. I call a doctor to give him a shot and stick around long enough to see it take hold on him. Don't want him jumping down those 10 stories into the swimming pool. Anita and I got back to my little pad in St. John's Wood, which I'd hardly used since I moved into it with Linda Keith. It was quite a difference for Anita after Courtfield Gardens. We were hiding out from Brian there, and that took a while. Brian and I still had to work together, and Brian made desperate attempts to get Anita back. There was no chance of that happening. Once Anita makes up her mind, she makes up her mind. But there was still this intense period of hiding out and negotiating with Brian, and he just used that as an even bigger excuse to get even more and more out there. It said that I stole her, but my take on it is that I rescued her. Actually, in a way, I rescued him, both of them. They were both on a very destructive course. Brian went to Paris and fell onto Anita's agent, howling that everyone had left him, fucked off and left him. He never forgave me. I don't blame him. He quickly got himself a chick, Suki Poitier, and we did somehow manage to tour together in March and April. Anita and I went to Rome that spring and summer, between the busts and the trials, where Anita played in Barbarella with Jane Fonda, directed by Jane's husband, Roger Vadim. Anita's Roman world centred around the Living Theatre, the famous anarchist pacifist troupe run by Judith Malina and Julian Beck, which had been around for years but was coming into its own in this period of activism and street demos. The Living Theatre was particularly insane, hardcore, its players often getting arrested on indecency charges. They had a play in which they recited lists of social taboos at the audience, for which they usually got a night in the slammer. Their main actor, a handsome black man named Rufus Collins, was a friend of Robert Fraser, and they were a part of the Andy Warhol and Gerard Malanga connection. And so it all went round in a little avant-garde elite, as often as not drawn together by a taste for drugs, of which the LT was a centre. And drugs were not copious in those days. The Living Theatre was intense, but it had glamour. There were all those beautiful people attached, like Danielle Luna, who was the first famous black model in America, and Nico, and all those girls who were hovering around. Danielle Luna was with one of the guys from the theatre. Talk about a tiger, a leopard, one of the most sinuous chicks I've ever seen. Not that I tried or anything. She obviously had her own agenda, and all backlit by the beauty of Rome, which gave it an added intensity. One night, when she was doing Barbarella, Anita ended up in prison. She was with some guys from the Living Theatre when she was pulled over for drugs, and the police thought she was a transvestite. They put her into the tank, and as soon as they opened the door, everybody went, "Anita, Anita." Everyone knew her. Talk about connections. And she's hissing, "Shut up!" Because her story was, she was the Black Queen and she couldn't be arrested. A bit of a theatrical number that she thought would appeal to the enlightened Romans or somehow divert them. She'd had to swallow a whole lump of hash when they caught her, so by then she was pretty high. They put her in a room with all the other queens, and eventually the next morning someone bailed her out. Those were days when police didn't really know how to handle the gender-bender varieties. they didn't really know what was going on. Anita's friends were, as ever, a hip crowd of the period. People like the actor Christian Macon, who directed Candy, the next film Anita worked on that summer, which starred, among a large cast of stars, Marlon Brando, who kidnapped her one night and read her poetry. When that failed, tried to seduce Anita and me together. Later, pal. There were Paul and Talitha Getty, who had the best and finest opium. I fell in with some other reprobates, like the writer Terry Southern, with whom I got on well, and the picaresque, scarcely believable figure of the period, Prince Stanislas Klasowski Nerola, known as Stash, son of the painter Balthus. Stash was an Anita connection, from Paris, who had been sent by Brian Jones to try and get Anita back. Instead, he fell in with the poacher, me. Stash had the bullshit credentials of the period, the patter of mysticism, the lofty talk of alchemy and the secret arts, all basically employed in the service of Legover. How gullible were the ladies. He was a roué and a playboy, like to look upon himself as Casanova. What an amazing creature to sweep through the 20th century. He played with Vince Taylor, an American rock and roller, who came over to England and never quite made it, but had a big success in France. Stash was in his band, playing tambourine with one black glove. He loved his music. He loved to dance in this weird, aristocratic way. I was always convinced Stash was going to break out into a minuet. He wanted to be one of the lads, but he could also do "I'm Prince Blah Blah," all hot air. We lived together in this magnificent palace, the Villa Medici, with its formal gardens, one of the most elegant buildings in the world, that Stash had managed to pull off. His father, Balthus, had an apartment there, some diplomatic role via the French Academy, which owned the building. Balthus was away, so we had his place to ourselves. Down the Spanish Steps for lunch. Nightclubs, hanging out at the Villa Medici. Going to the gardens of the Villa Borghese. It was my version of the Grand Tour. There was also this undercurrent of revolution in the air. A lot of political undertones, all half-assed except for the Red Brigades later. Before the riots in Paris the following year, the students started a revolution at the University of Rome, which I went to. They barricaded it. They sneaked me in. They were all flash-in-the-pan revolutionaries. Me, I had nothing to do, really. Sometimes I go to the studio and see Vonda and Vadim at work. Anita went to work, and I didn't. Like some sort of Roman pimp or something. Send the woman to work and hang about. It was weird. I was enjoying it, but at the same time, there was that sort of itch. Shouldn't I be doing something? Meanwhile, Tom Keelock is there with my Bentley. Blue Lena had loudspeakers in the grill, and Anita used to terrorize the Romans by putting on a woman policeman's voice, reading out their number plates and ordering them to turn immediately to the right. The car flew a Vatican flag with the keys of St. Peter. Marianne and Mick stayed with us for a while. Hear Marianne on the subject. Now that's a trip I'll never forget. Me and Mick and Keith and Anita and Stash. On acid at night in the full moon at the Villa Medici. It was just utterly beautiful. And Anita's smile, I remember. I mean, her wonderful smile in those days, which promised everything. When she was having a good time, she was so full of promise. She gave this incredible smile, which was quite frightening, too. All those teeth, like a wolf, like a cat that got the cream. If you were a man, it must have been very powerful. She was gorgeous because she was so beautifully dressed. Always in the perfect costume. Anita had a huge influence on the style of the times. She could put anything together and look good. I was beginning to wear her clothes most of the time. I would wake up and put on what was lying around. Sometimes it was mine, and sometimes it was the old lady's. But we were the same size, so it didn't matter. If I sleep with someone, I at least have the right to wear clothes. But it really pissed off Charlie Watts, with his walking cupboards of impeccable Savile Row suits, that I started to become a fashion icon for wearing my old lady's clothes. Otherwise, it was plunder, loot that I wore. Whatever was thrown at me on stage or what I picked up off stage and happened to fit, I would say to somebody, oh, I like that shirt. And for some reason, they felt obliged to give it to me. I used to dress myself by taking clothes off other people. I was never really interested very much in my look, so to speak. Although I might be a liar there. I used to spend hours stitching old pants together to give them a different look. I'd get four pairs of sailor pants. I'd cut them off at the knee, get a band of leather, and then put another colour from the other pair of pants and stitch them in. Lavender and dull rose, as Cecil Beaton says. I didn't realise he was keeping an eye on that shit. I did enjoy hanging out with Stash and his degenerates. But look who's talking. They cover my fucking ass, right? I had no particular desire to get into that area of society, a European bullshit high society. I'd use them when I could. I don't want to knock the man. I always like to hang with him. And yes, I could say he's so shallow you couldn't paddle in it. And Stash would know exactly what I mean. And he knows he deserves it, little snipe. He got enough out of me, and I let him get away with a few things. I know exactly how tough he is. One kick out the bum, and he's gone. I used to believe in law and order and British Empire. I thought Scotland Yard was incorruptible. Wonderful. I fell for the whole shtick. The coppers I came up against taught me what it was really about. Amazing to think now that I was shocked, but I was. The bus we were subjected to was set against the background of massive corruption in Metropolitan Police at the time, and for the next few years, which culminated in the Commissioner publicly firing a great many CID officers and prosecuting others. It was only by getting busted that we realised how fragile the structure really was. They're shitting themselves with fear now because they've busted us and they don't know what to do with us. It was sort of eye-opening. What have they got at Redlands? Some Italian speed that Mick had on script anyway. And they found some smack on Robert Fraser and that was it. And because they found a few roaches in the ashtray, I got done for allowing people to smoke marijuana on my premises. It was so tenuous. They got nothing out of it. In fact, what they got was a big black eye. On the day, almost on the hour, that Mick and I were charged, on May 10th, 1967, Brian Jones was simultaneously busted in his apartment in London. The stitch-up was orchestrated and synchronised with rare precision. But due to some small glitch of stage management, the press actually arrived, television crews included, a few minutes before the police knocked on Brian's door with their warrant. The police had to push through the army of hacks they'd summoned to get to the door. But his collusion was barely noticeable in the farce that unfolded. The Redlands trial in late June was in Chichester, which was still in 1930 when it came to the judicials. On the bench was Judge Block, who was probably 60-odd, about my age now at the time. This was my first ever show in court. You don't know how you're going to react. In fact, I had no choice. He was so offensive, obviously trying to provoke me so that he could do what he wanted. He called me for having used my premises for the smoking of cannabis resin, scum and filth, and said, "People like this shouldn't be allowed to walk free." So when the prosecutor said to me, surely I must have known what was going on, what with a naked girl wrapped in a rug, which is basically what I was being done for, I did not just say, "Oh, sorry, Your Honour." The actual exchange went as follows. There was, as we know, a young woman sitting on a settee wearing only a rug. Would you agree, in the ordinary course of events, you would expect a young woman to be embarrassed if she had nothing on but a rug in the presence of eight men, two of whom were hangers-on and the third a Moroccan servant? Not at all. You regard that, do you, as quite normal? We're not old men. We're not worried about petty morals. It got me a year in Wormwood Scrumps. I only did a day, as it turned out, but that was what the judge thought of my speech. He gave me the heaviest sentence he thought he could get away with. I found out later that Judge Block was married to the heiress of Shipham's fish paste. If I'd known about his fishwife, I could have come out with a better one. We'll leave it at that. That day, June 29th, 1967, I was found guilty and sentenced to 12 months in prison. Robert Fraser was given 6 months and Mick 3 months. Mick was in Brixton. Fraser and I went to the Scrubs that night. What a ludicrous sentence. I mean, how much do they hate you? I wonder who was whispering in the judge's ear. If he had listened to Wise information, he would have said, "I'll just treat this as 25 quid and out of here. This case is nothing." In retrospect, the judge actually played into our hands. He managed to turn it into a great PR coup for us. Even though I must say I didn't enjoy Wormwood Scrubs, even for 24 hours. The judge managed to turn me into some folk hero overnight. I've been playing up to it ever since. But the dark side of this was discovering that we'd become the focal point of a nervous establishment. There's two ways the authorities can deal with a perceived challenge. One is to absorb and the other is to nail. They had to leave the Beatles alone because they'd already given them medals. We got the nail. It was more serious than I thought. I was in jail because I'd obviously pissed off the authorities. I'm a guitar player in a pop band, and I'm being targeted by the British government and its vicious police force, all of which shows me how frightened they are. We won two world wars, right? And these people are shivering in their goddamn boots. "All of your children will be like this if you don't stop this right now." There was such ignorance on both sides. We didn't know we were doing anything that was going to bring the empire crashing to the floor. And they were searching in the sugar bowls, not knowing what they were looking for. But it didn't stop them trying again and again and again and again for the next 18 months. It coincided with their learning about drugs. They'd never heard of them before. I used to walk down Oxford Street with a slab of hash as big as a skateboard. I wouldn't even wrap it up. This was 65, 66. It was that brief moment of total freedom. We didn't even think that it was illegal what we were doing. And they knew nothing about drugs at all. But once that came on the menu in about 67, they saw their opportunity as a source of income or a source of promotion or another avenue to make more arrests. It's easy to bust a hippie, and it got very easy to plant a couple of joints on people. It was just so common that you expected it. Most of the first day of the prison sentence was induction. You get in with the rest of the inductees and take a shower, and they spray you with lye spray.